Well, greetings once again to everybody out there at TFMR. It's Thursday. It's noon Eastern. That means it's time for A to A. We've taken a couple of weeks off. We've had some holidays to deal with, some vacation. But now we are back, and who better to break the ice than our buddy Denver Dave Kranzler. He's a frequent guest here at TFMR. He runs his own site, Investment Research Dynamics. He's got two great newsletters that I know many of you are already subscribers to, but it's something you should all check out. One is the Mining Stock Journal. The other one is the Short Sellers Journal, all available, again, through investmentresearchdynamics.com. Dave, thank you so much for stopping by again. How are you today?
Well, all things considered, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back in Turdville.
Boy, we got a lot going on, my friend. It is all of a sudden, things have gotten really, really interesting. We'll get to everybody's questions in a minute, and just as a reminder, we use this GoToWebinar platform so that anybody listening can submit questions in real time for the guest. The way you do that is through the control panel for GoToWebinar that has popped up on your screen when you logged in. You hit the questions tab, you type it in. That comes to me. I relay it on to Dave at the appropriate time. But first, we always like to start with my own questions. And so, Dave, I want to dive right in, though, with something pending today that I know you'd like to address. We had this news today on one of the stocks you follow called Tahoe Resources. And I know there are folks here on the site that were wondering about your thoughts on that. Why don't I just let you pick it up and run with it and tell us what you think is going on there.
Sure. Actually, Tahoe Resources was that was my featured stock in my debut issue of the Mining Stock Journal. And in general, the journal focuses on exploration junior miners as opposed to Tahoe, which is obviously a mid bordering on large cap producer. So, and they produce a ton of silver out of their mine in Guatemala, and there's always been a little bit of political risk discount associated with the stock versus First Majestic. I mean, outright on just, if you just look at the fundamentals of Tahoe versus First Majestic, outside of the fact that it's, the mine is in Guatemala, Tahoe is very cheap relative to First Majestic. They actually also diversified. They bought Lakeshore Gold, so they have, you know, it's basically a silver and gold mining company now. So they're actually producing gold and silver. And what happened? And again, I'm not really quite sure on the legality or the legal issues involved, because I literally didn't see it until I woke up this morning, and I had several emails from subscribers asking me what my thoughts were. And so I've really only had a chance to just kind of do a cursory read of the press release, but it looks like the issue there, the Supreme Court of Guatemala has ruled that the allegation is that Tahoe did not adhere to some mining convention that allows one of the native parties down there to do a supervisory inspection of the mine or something like that. Again, I'm not quite 100% clear on the details. I want to talk to management about it. But if you read through what Tahoe says, they think that they can appeal it and get it overruled. They think that the specific provision in Guatemalan mining law does not apply to them. Apparently, the native organization doesn't really exist on the property that where they have their mine. And again, I'm just going by what the press release says. I want to talk to management before I can fully understand what's going on. But it sounds like, if anything, it's going to be a 2 to 3 month suspension of the mining operations. So, and one of the things that I want to find out is if they've got business interruption insurance, and I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
And whether or not, you know, this specific allegation would apply to business interruption, you know, that might be some sort of clause that where the business interruption insurance might not apply. I need to get those answers from management. I mean, at the end of the day, I think what it sounds like to me, and what I've emailed back to subscribers, and I meant to send out a notice to the entire subscription base early this morning. I just didn't have time. But what it sounds like to me is that they're being held up at gunpoint for some cash by the entity that has filed the claim or the lawsuit against them. And, you know, again, I think it's something that's going to be resolved. And this is a mining operation that employs a lot of people. It provides a lot of tax revenues for the country. I think it makes it, I think this is a great buy opportunity for Tahoe. And in the small hedge fund that I manage, I bought a lot of December 7.5 calls for 35, 40 cents this morning. And again, those are somewhat risky, and I did it. The only reason I bought those calls instead of in the money calls that are closer to, you know, not as far out as December, you know, to kind of minimize the premium I pay, is because I haven't spoken to management yet. But once I talk to management, you know, I'm probably going to also either outright buy the stock in the fund or, you know, kind of buy at the money calls, buy a lot of them, you know, that are a month or two out just to get the leverage from the calls.
So it's, they produce, I've seen numbers as much as 20 million ounces a year. Is that right?
Again, I don't know this is one of those stocks that I had kind of considered a low maintenance stock. So I don't really,
sure.
I don't really spend a lot of time looking at it. You know, it's the exploration juniors that I follow. Those are the ones that are high maintenance and you got to stay on top
of. Sure. Yeah. Well, regardless, I mean, that's a lot of silver that is, offline, won't be coming to market over the next couple of months. You would think, hey, maybe that would have some impact on the price today. But of course, you know, I mean, we're not trading physical silver to determine price. We're trading derivatives. To that end, we've had silver's had a tough year, Dave. It's actually down now year to date. What do you ascribe that to? Is it just, again, is it just the derivative trading? Is it something that you think could turn around as we go through the rest of this year? What do you make of silver here?
You know, I think it's just one of those things. I think, you know, the Western Central Banks and the Bullion Bank, I think they're kind of in a mode right now where they're doing what they can to prevent gold and silver from moving higher, you know. And my personal opinion on it is, in some ways, it feels like what occurred in starting in March 2008, where they took the price of gold down from about 1,030, yeah, 1,020, ultimately down to, you know, close to 700. Yeah. I think it even went below 700 intraday in the futures market on one of the days. And silver was taken down from, I believe it was around 21 and down to, I don't know,
$7 or $8.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know I bought a lot of silver back when that happened, and the premiums were a couple bucks over spot as well, and they actually got higher during that period. But I just think that if you look at the financial and geopolitical risk that, and especially the political risk here. Yeah. That is sort of built up over the last, really since the Fed started its QE program, but it's really intensified. I don't think we've ever seen a time in our lifetime when the financial, economic, and geopolitical risk has been as high as it is right now. And so the fact that the stock markets keep going up and they just keep ignoring all of the risks that are building and accumulating, and the fact that at least right now, I mean, let's remember, I mean, gold and silver are still positive on the year to date. So to the extent that they're trying to push down the price of gold and silver to try and mute the you know, the smoke alarm role that gold plays in you know, it, reflecting the fact that there's a huge amount of just incredible risk out there in the whole, you know, systemic risk. You know, I don't think they're as successful right now, at least, at pushing it lower to the extent that they were in 2008. But recall in 2008, they pushed it a lot lower, and then all of a sudden we had essentially a de facto financial system collapse.
Right, right.
After Lehman went in the tank, and Goldman and AIG should have gone in the tank. So I think we're probably headed towards something like that, or, you know, God forbid, you know, maybe some sort of geopolitical event is coming. And I think they know that the price of gold and silver are going to go crazy, and they want it to start going crazy from a lower level than it might otherwise. And the reason for that is as you and your audience well knows, as you know as well as anyone, the derivative paper short interest in gold and silver are as high as I've ever seen them. And I say that saying that we don't know exactly what the over-the-counter derivative gold and silver paper short exposure is by the, you know, let's just call them a cabal, for lack of a better term. We just know it's high. And, I mean, you can see that when you look at the COMEX open interest. I mean, the silver open interest is over 200,000 contracts.
Again.
I didn't have time to look at it yet this morning, but, I mean, that's especially relative to where the price of silver is now versus, you know, the last time around when the silver open interest was hovering over 200,000, which was when silver was up close to $50.
I mean, actually, back then, Dave, it was closer to 140 or 150,000.
Right, and I think
all
it
the way
did.
Back then.
And now we're 200,000. Nosed over 200,000 briefly.
I don't mean to jump in and correct you, but actually, back in the day in 2011, it was routinely about 135,000, 145,000. We didn't see 200,000 until last year. With prices all the way down here. And, I mean, that's 1 billion ounces of paper silver when the world doesn't even produce 900 million.
I mean, it's just outright fraud in COMEX contracts because they could never, you know, if even half of the people who are long those contracts stood for delivery, they'd never be able to fulfill them. I don't know that they could fulfill 10%, you know, of the people standing or the entities standing.
Right. Dave, let me ask you about this. I've already gotten questions piled up, so I don't want to take too much time with this. But I just in a broad sense, everybody here knows what I think about Yellen and the Fed and the, you know, the criminal bankers and what their intentions are. You know, after that last hike, Neil Cash and Carry up there in Minneapolis, who I think he's trying to position himself for Yellen's job. You know, when that comes up next year. But anyway, he said that the Fed is no longer, basically what he said, I'm paraphrasing, was the Fed no longer is data dependent. They're not raising rates on data. They're raising data. They're raising rates on hope because the data is so terrible. Okay, that's maybe given some legitimacy to what they're doing. Do you think there's, are they just simply acting in their own best interest? You know, they're trying to hike and help their banks. Are they hiking so that they can cut, like some people say? What the heck do you think is going on? Because the economic data, obviously, is no better than it's been any time in the last 8 years. But all of a sudden, you know, we're getting a quarter basis point rate hike every 90 days. What do you think the Fed is attempting to accomplish?
That's a great question. And, you know, all I can do is guess like everyone else.
Right.
You know, without being a fly on the wall inside those meetings. And in reality, I think what you really need to be able to do is get behind the FOMC and see what they're being told to say by the Fed researchers. Because I think that's where the directives really come from. I think these guys sitting on the FOMC are figureheads. They're essentially academic figureheads, and all they do is read what's put in front of them. I mean, out of the last three Fed heads, the only guy who could ad lib and say something, even though it was in a roundabout way, could say anything meaningful was Greenspan.
Yeah.
And Bernanke, and even worse, is Yellen. I mean, half the stuff she says doesn't make any sense. It's just so convoluted.
Right.
So I mean, if their motive is to quote unquote help the banks, well, they're not doing that by raising short-term rates because it's causing the yield curve to flatten, and that kills the net interest margin that banks earn. And in my short seller's journal, I had put Goldman Sachs as a short in there, I don't know, a while ago. It was at 223. I'm not even sure where Goldman is today, but it actually traded down to like 210 or 212 shortly after that, to 27 right now. But I looked at one of the things I looked at, because one of the areas where they really, you know, generate real cash is in their net interest margin, their cost of borrowing from the Fed versus where they lend it out, you know, in their lending operations. And their net interest margin between, again, I'm just doing these numbers off the top of my head, but I want to say 2008 and now, their net interest margin has been cut in half because of the shape of the yield curve. It's flattened out, and the yield curve has flattened out quite a bit since the Fed started raising. So I don't think that their goal is to help the banks per se, because they're not doing that by raising short-term rates right now, unless they just said, hey, we gave the banks $2.5 trillion of quantitative, quote-unquote quantitative easing money, you know, and that's the help we're giving them right now. We need to take back some of the rate cuts so we can save them for later and push rates down again. And that may be what the motive is at this point. I'm not really sure. And yeah, I haven't found any explanation out there where I can say, ah, that's got to be it.
Yeah,
other than they're raising them now so they can lower them later. And that's probably, for me, the most logical explanation. It's certainly not data dependent, because the Fed researchers have access to much better data than we have access to on this side of the curtain. And so they know better than we do what's going on in the real economy. And, you know, the statistically manipulated economic reports right now are having trouble hiding, you know, what's going on in the real economy, which is essentially, you know, we're heading into a tailspin.
Right. Let's bury some demand in RV sales, because certainly nobody will look there. And
that's all debt driven, those RV sales. I did a little bit of research on it, and it's as easy to get an RV loan as it is to get a car loan.
Sure, or a home loan. Yeah.
Right.
Tenement on wheels, right? Like Clark Griswold called it. I've got four or five questions in the queue, so I better dive right into them, my friend. The first one is something I was going to ask you about anyway, from Ted. It's basically about the COT. I know you follow it every week. There's going to be another improvement this week. I'm almost certain of that when we see it on Friday. But as of last week, the one thing that really caught my eye is some of the positioning in silver, the large spec gross short position. So you're talking fuel for a short squeeze, is the highest it's been since early August of 2015. And I'm sure it's going to be higher again this week just from tracking the open interest versus price change. Now that's bullish, but at the same time, we know that's not something that means it's bullish now. You know, that the COT is never something that you can, you know, trade on and say, okay, I've seen the COT, now I got to trade. And that's kind of what Ted's question is. I mean, do you think a bottom is in for price? I think he's probably talking about silver, but maybe gold too. Or could this kind of malaise carry on for another, you know, in a sense, maybe into the fourth quarter? Ted, just wondering what you think.
Oh, I don't think this will carry on into the fourth quarter. I think we'll see some resolve to this. What is this, early July, maybe even by the end of the month, mid-August. I'm just looking at this silver COT right now, and what this trend has been happening, as you were alluding to, Craig, for several weeks now, whereby the commercial category, the producer, merchant, and the swap dealers, and for all intents and purposes, most of that is the bullion banks. Let's just call them the banks.
Right. Yes.
Where the banks have been covering their shorts and adding longs, essentially significantly reducing Yeah, adding to their longs, and it's really more covering their shorts as opposed to adding to their longs. At least what I've been noticing. Like if you look at the last COT report, the producer merchant covered 4,600 shorts and added 418 longs. And then you go and you look at the hedge funds, and the hedge funds are now they've been dumping their longs and adding to their shorts. And I think what's happened, and I've noticed this probably since maybe 2012, 2013. It seems like what happens here is you get a cycle where the price starts to, you know, as the price goes higher, the banks start shorting the crap out of gold and silver, and they take their net short position to an extreme long, and they seduce the hedge funds into going into an extreme net long position, you know, because they know it's black box algo programs that chase momentum. And then when they decide to pull the plug on the price, they use the banks obviously use that as an opportunity to cover their shorts. And as they're covering their shorts and adding to longs slowly, all of a sudden the hedge funds start dumping their longs and going short. And when I looked at the COT report briefly earlier this week, I didn't really see. I'm looking at the managed money position, and if the managed money position changes to the same degree that it changed last week, the hedge funds are going to be net short at the end of, you know, when the next COT report comes out. And I'm not saying they will for sure, but they're going to be pretty close to flat.
Right. Well, so I might add on, just to add on to that, Dave, if we get a change like I think we're going to see, we're going to be very close to the record of gross short position just in the large spec category in silver. That record was on a COT that was taken back on the 7th of July 2 years ago, 2015. And again, price stayed down all the way in December. So it didn't mean that it was immediately going to go higher. But nonetheless, the banks had basically transferred a large part of the risk of being short from their sheets onto the specs. And then magically, price went from 14 to 21 over the course of the next, 10 months. So,
yeah, magically. Yeah. I think that period of time you're talking about, I think the hedge funds were briefly net short silver, if I recall.
Yeah, and the banks got all the way down to where they were almost, actually in gold, I think is where it was, where you could really see it. The banks almost got all the way down to being net long a couple
That's
times
right.
in December of that year.
That's then, right.
Look what happened.
At my office, I could pull up the spreadsheets. I have all that information, yeah. But I'm not at my office right now, so.
Let me give you the next question.
So I guess really just to address Ted's question really quickly.
Sure.
I think we're approaching a bottom. You know, can they on any given day can they come in and bomb the market when there's no one around and very little trading activity like they did on Monday? Yeah, sure. And they're probably going to try to do that. But I don't know that's going to stay down for very long. And I think we're at the point now, you're never going to time the bottom perfectly. And anyone
right.
who says they do is lying.
Right.
But we're at the point now where I think you want to buy dips.
And it's the same principle. I mean, if you think that it's crazy that the banks are going to lose money as price continues to rise when they're short, right? I mean, they always seem to wash them back out. Well, when it gets to the point where the risk is on the specs and the specs profit when price goes down, it ain't going down either. You know, it's not that complicated.
Right.
All right, here's the next question for you. This one was emailed to me from Scott. And he just wants, and I don't know if this is something you can address or not, so I'll let you do with this as you'd like. He has a question on confiscation. And his thoughts are about setting up an LLC or maybe an S-Corp or something, to buy larger amounts of physical metal for himself to offset the risk that there might be confiscation from individuals but not corporations or LLCs. Do you know anything about that?
I get these confiscation questions quite a bit, and I think, to me, my personal opinion is the confiscation thing is sort of the internet boogeyman. Because if you look at what happened when the confiscation order was issued by FDR, they got very little gold and silver, or not silver, very little gold.
Right.
And it was voluntary. You know, you had to turn it in voluntarily. And in doing a lot of research on this, several years ago. The only gold they really got that was meaningful was gold that was left behind in bank safety deposit boxes, abandoned safety deposit boxes. Why, how those get abandoned, I have no idea, but you know, maybe some old geezer has a bunch of gold in his bank safety deposit box that his family doesn't know about, and he dies before he can tell anyone. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I know a lot of, because I'm very good friends with a longtime numismatic coin dealer, and through him I found out that what happened, a lot of very wealthy people who probably knew the confiscation order was coming, moved their gold coins over to Europe. And part of this guy's business is bidding on, you know, there's dealers that go over there and bring the coins back, on at behest of the family, or sometimes, the family's not even around anymore and they bring the coins back and they auction them off. And so this guy he's been over there himself to bring them back, and he's also bid on them. So, I mean, my feeling is the next time around, if they ever do issue a confiscation order, is, the conditions of what's going on in the country economically and politically and militarily are such that I think whether or not, they want you to turn in your gold or not is going to be the least of our problems. So it's not really something I worry about. I think the best way to address it is just keep your gold and silver under your own possession, under your own lock and key. I don't know why people have a problem with doing that. Everyone wants to do this, oh, well, should I move some to Canada or move some to Mexico? Well, guess what? Good luck getting there if things get really bad and they just decide to close the borders in and out.
Exactly.
So that's my thing. I mean, and if you're worried about the political conditions getting so extreme that they decide they have to, issue order saying gold and silver is illegal in this country, then you should probably think about relocating outside the country now, because by the time those orders come down, if they ever do, and I'm skeptical that they ever will, you're probably not going to be able to get out of the country.
Right, right. And if you're going to go, take your gold with you now.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, that's kind of how I feel about it. I don't really worry about it. I think it's kind of a, there's certain websites out there, and we all know who they are, and they base a big part of their business on, you got to diversify where you keep your gold and silver. Well, no, I don't. I want to keep it under my own watch because I'm the only one I trust. Once you put your gold and silver outside of your control into a custodian, you've got counterparty risk.
Right, right. And there are a lot of those places out there as part
That's
of
right.
the scheme. All right, next question comes from Dan. I'll just ask you this and just let you go wherever you want with it. Dave, what do you think of Andrew McGuire's prediction that gold physical demand and price is going to surge in the next few days due to some event?
Well, I thought he said 26 days, and I looked up the date the interview was posted, and it was June 9th. So 26 days would have been yesterday.
Right.
So... I'm not pedantic enough to hold him to a specific date. I'm very friendly with Eric King, and I like Eric King. But I don't know why Andrew McGuire gets onto Eric King's interviews and makes these predictions, because they never come true.
Yeah.
At some point, he's going to lose all credibility.
That's what I've warned. I mean, you've heard me say before, price and date in the same sentence is often not a real good idea.
It's suicide, I mean, if he has an inside line to some event that's going to cause gold and silver to take off, just say sometime in July. Why do you have to say 26
right.
days,
Right.
And then
yeah.
I get these emails from subscribers and non-subscribers, and they're like, you can tell they're kind of banking on hope that he's right. And I'm like,
right.
don't assume
right.
he's right. He probably isn't. It's been his history.
When he first started talking about it back in February or March or whenever it was, I talked to him and I said, Andy, I mean, seriously, you're going to stick your neck out on this one? And he was supremely confident that the stuff he's working on, which is some pretty big time stuff, was all going to hit within that whatever 3 to 6 month time frame he originally gave back in February. So, but I haven't talked to him for a while, so I know nothing more than just about anybody else. But anyway, next question is a follow-up from Ted. This gets to your mining stock expertise. Ted said he listened to the Sandstorm Gold conference call this morning, And he says that under $4 a share, he thinks Sandstorm's a pretty strong buy. Do you have any thoughts on it?
Oh, I've put my money where my mouth is on that, as a matter of fact. Now, I just want to qualify one thing. I would say alleged mining stock expert in reference to me.
I know the feeling.
When, for me, what put Sandstorm really on my radar screen, and I'd been asked to look at it for a long time, and I'm like, well, everyone else looks at it, so I don't have anything I can bring to the table. But I did put Mariana Resources. That was a feature stock in my short seller journal in December at 82 cents. This is the U.S. dollar price. And I said, you know, this Mariana is extremely undervalued. It's potential home run. Little did I know they were going to get taken over, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 months later. And my subscribers who jumped into it had a really nice rate of return on Mariana. Well, when the acquisition was announced, Sandstorm stock just got bludgeoned. And I don't have the graph right in front of me, but I want to say Sandstorm was hit down to around the 330 level or something, maybe even a little lower. Part of it was because they're issuing stock as part of the acquisition, and part of it was also that acquisition, that deal was announced right at the time the GDXJ nonsense was reaching a peak. So Sandstorm got caught up in both. And the way that what I did is, and Mariana got, you know, its price got hit because of the stock component of the offer. So in my fund, as a intermediate or shorter term sort of, I guess, call it a swing trade play for lack of a better term, I put Mariana and Sandstorm into our fund at the right, you know, right at, I got lucky and it wasn't at the bottom, but it was pretty close to the bottom. And I kind of looked at them as cash equivalents. And I just said, you know, at some point when this GDXJ thing blows over, Sandstorm's going to go back to where it was before it got hit. And, you know, when the acquisition's taken, you know, is completed. And that was well over $4. So I've kind of pieced out the Mariana I bought over time to, you know, to pursue other ideas that are longer term plays for our fund. But we still own the Sandstorm, and I'm holding it until it goes back to, you know, 450 or higher. And I think the market doesn't really appreciate exactly what they're getting with Mariana, because Mariana potentially is sitting on a very large copper gold porphyry in Turkey that is, again, I have to freshen up my research on it, but they're not too far away from actually producing, from putting in a mine. So, and they also have some other very interesting properties over in Turkey that, you know, I'm sure Sandstorm initially bought it for the copper gold almost mine, but some of the other properties also are very interesting.
Okay.
So yeah, I love Sandstorm would be the short answer here.
Fair enough. All right. Kevin has a couple of questions, but it begins with an observation that, the income earned on excess reserves goes up every time that the FOMC hikes the Fed funds rate, or not every time, but almost every time it seems. So maybe that's also kind of a windfall for the banks in hiking the Fed funds rate. That's one of the first things he said. Do you agree with that, I guess? Maybe?
You know, I didn't even really think about the IOER when they hiked the rate, but it doesn't go up enough to compensate them for the flattening of the yield curve.
Yeah, and going back to that, I mean, we have had the Draghi has helped out. I wrote about it this morning over the last 8 or 9 days. I mean, that we long rates have moved up 25 basis points back to where they were before this last hike. You know, and all this job owning about the balance sheet is about trying to move long rates up too. So they're trying. They're just not having much success, you know, to keep the yield curve positively sloped. Kevin's other question is, and I don't know if you know anything about this. It's written as if maybe you do, so I'll just lay this out there for you. Big boy bail-in ruling, the proposed rule to restrict qualified financial contracts by Governor Tarullo. Any update? Is that something you know about?
I'm not familiar with that at all.
Okay, you wrote that as if maybe that was something you knew about.
No, I'm not really paying a lot of attention to the bail-in concept until it actually starts really happening for real, especially in this country. I guess it sort of has happened over in Europe, and I know they're putting in the provisions in place in Congress so that it happens here. I'm not against a bail-in because I think that the stakeholders in banks are the ones who should bear the risk of a bank going tits up. It shouldn't be the taxpayers. So, if I want them to start, I hope the bail-ins happen. Because the TARP and the Fed printing in 2008 bailed out all these stakeholders in these banks. And I think people don't understand what kind of risks they're taking when they invest in these banks. And those risks shouldn't be insured against by the taxpayer.
All right. Question from Terry. This gets back to silver and the COMEX. We were talking about earlier about the risk of the banks, and you remember the story about how the squeeze in 2011 was really a squeeze of the commercials, particularly J.P. Morgan. Remember how they rushed through with a vault, Dave, back like in June of that year then,
Oh,
because they
yeah.
didn't have a vault. And now they've got something like 110 million ounces in their COMEX vault. More than half of the silver vaulted on the COMEX is held by J.P. Morgan. Terry's question is specifically about Ted Butler's assertion of how much physical silver they might have. Again, we know about the 110 million ounces on the COMEX. And I want to point out, too, he wants to know what you think about why J.P. Morgan holds this silver and how much more they might have. Ted Butler says they might have four times as much as what they show in their COMEX vaults. But I think this is interesting, Dave. Remember how they exceeded the position limit back in March, in the March deliveries? Remember, you and I both wrote about that. Because
Yes.
they weren't supposed to have more than 1,500 contracts. That's a position limit. They hit 2,689 for deliveries.
Yes.
Well, since then, and after taking deliveries, on a large scale for every month and all the way back through 2015, J.P. Morgan did not, the house account of J.P. Morgan didn't stop or issue a single contract back in May. And so far in July, they haven't stopped or issued a single contract. And in April and June in gold, they didn't do anything either. So are they just done acquiring silver? Anyway, that's just kind of a broad observation. And I guess I'll just stop there and let you kind of pick up the ball and run with your thoughts.
Sure. My problem with Ted Butler's analysis is all we have to go by are these caught reports. Unless you have inside access to the books at JP Morgan, you don't know what's really going on with the silver that's being reported in the COMEX vaults. We have no idea. It's, as far as I'm concerned, especially the daily open interest or even the caught reports per se, but for sure the inventory reports, the warehouse reports, it's hearsay evidence.
What's it
We
say at
have
the
to take
bottom?
it. It
This is
doesn't get
not
independently audited. The reports are put together by the banks themselves. I mean, as an example, if you look at the caught reports, I mean, there's strange behavior that goes on in the forget off the top of my head what they call it. There's the managed money and there's the retail and then there's
All
the
that garbage, right?
yeah. So that sort of intermediate account that's on the non-commercial side, there's always some strange movements that go on in there. It's supposed to be represent like family offices and sort of institutional but not really institutional investors and traders.
It's
So
their fudge factor account.
it's large traders that aren't in the managed money category is essentially what it is. Yeah. And so, we can't really know for sure. Are there footprints in the snow that suggest JP Morgan's accumulating a lot of silver? Sure they are. If you track the house account versus the client account deliveries, the delivery reports. So, look, I mean, you and I and your audience knows well that whatever's happening, the inside banks are going to be set up to profit handsomely for it. So if JP Morgan is setting up extremely long from a physical silver standpoint, and they just plan on defaulting on their paper, on their paper silver shorts, which is probably what'll happen, that's you know, it's, they're in the seat to be able to do that. And all we can do is be outsiders looking in. And I don't like to put full faith in arguments like Ted Butler makes, because, you know, again, we can't really say for sure. You know, we can suspect it, but at the end of the day, you know, does it really matter where that silver really is or who has ownership to it? I mean, all we know is it's not going to be delivered into the paper obligations that, you know, that are supposed to be backed by that silver, right?
Right, right.
And the other aspect to JP Morgan, we don't know what's going on in their OTC derivatives. You know, we have no idea what's going on there, and we don't know what's going on in their foreign operations. I mean, I seem to recall along the way reading that, you know, they've got some big vaults over in Singapore and Hong Kong, you know, and who knows what they're doing there.
Yeah. I got an update from Kevin. He sent me a link. What he was referring to, and I probably just didn't describe this very well, was something he wrote back in early May. You'll recall, he said, like a mafia don protecting his family, the Fed is implementing another layer of protection. This latest deal will prevent bank counterparties from pulling collateral from a collapsing bank. I think that's what he was referring to.
I think that's been a gradual, that legislation's been implemented gradually over time. I mean, recall, and I don't remember how many years ago it was, but it was the rule was put in place that at bank holding companies, derivatives stood first in line ahead of any secured creditor of a bank.
Yeah, this was actually May 2016 when you wrote about that.
Yeah, that's a long time ago.
You smoked a lot of weed since then. You can't remember what you did last week. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I haven't done that, but I mean, that's a long time ago. I'd have to look at the article itself.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just joking.
All right, let's just put it this way. You know, all of the rules and regulations that have been put in place since 2008, and really before that, you can go, you know, before that, all the rules and the financial rules and regulations, they've been put in place to protect the banks at the expense of everyone else.
Yeah.
And so what Kevin's referring to is probably another ruling that just added another layer of protection to the banks.
Yeah. And that's what it was. Maybe I'll put that link here on this page so people can go back and read it. All right.
I need to go back and read it.
Robert just adds that he's a subscriber here and to the Short Sellers Journal. And then he loves them both. He said, I've noticed that my SSJ positions are becoming more green on my screen as my PM miners are going more red, so I have a little balance, which is what I was hoping for. Thank you from Bob. So anyway, Bob, there's an endorsement of what you do. And then question here, kind of a follow-up from Ted. Do you think, I'll just read the whole thing. He thinks there's another meltdown coming bigger than 2008. However, the market manipulation computer algorithms are much more improved since then and seem to come to the rescue every time. Do you think the computers will be able to thwart the next big meltdown? If not, is there any investment that you like to benefit from a meltdown like the VIX? Or will you just mainly rely on specific shorts?
I think you could do either. I think you can buy calls on the VIX or, you know, buy a VIX ETF outright, or you can look at publications like my Short Seller Journal. There's not option services out there, actually, that are geared towards shorting the market, understandably. In fact, I'm kind of surprised that I, you know, almost all my subscribers that have signed on over the time since I've started it, most of them have hung in there, which I was kind of surprised. But, you know, I think we know what a lot of the obvious shorts are, like Tesla and Amazon and probably Apple, even though they have cash that'll help them, but they also have a lot of debt. You know, in general, the FANG stocks, a lot of these recent IPOs, I think Snap's still has a ton of downside here when the shit really starts to hit the fan. So I think you can do either. I think you can short the market or go long the VIX or both. Or, I mean, really, the only way to be for sure hedged is just, you know, own as much physical gold and silver as you can in your own possession.
Now, Dave, what are you, some kind of conspiracy nut? Mother herself assured us just a week ago that there will not be another financial crisis in our lifetimes. So come on, man.
Wait, let me take my tinfoil hat off here to answer that. Jeez. Let's not forget that Ben Bernanke in mid-2007 said the housing and mortgage market was fine.
Yeah, that's right. Do you think, do you worry? I mean, if you know, the shares are shares for that matter. And the shares got the snot kicked out of them in 2008, but that's also, you know, the gold and silver, as we noted earlier, also early in 2008 and 2009 were getting killed too. From these levels, would a 20% overall stock market decline impact the shares, or do you think the metals would rally and keep the shares afloat? I mean, you have a, I mean, so would the shares participate if suddenly we did have a pretty stout equity bear market?
Well, they did in 2008, right?
Right.
I mean, I want to say late October, early November. Gold and silver, I think, actually started moving higher mid to late October, and then I think the Huey bottomed in late October 2008. Again, don't hold me to that specifically, but it was right around there. And the gold and silver started moving higher. I mean, the Huey, I believe, slightly more than doubled between like November, early November and the end of the year in 2008, while the S&P kept going lower. And the S&P didn't bottom out until, I want to say, March or April 2009.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I you know, I get this question a lot, believe it or not. And my, you know, my answer is, I mean, no one knows for sure what's going to happen, but, you know, just judging from what's happened in the past, you know, when the market starts to go into an extended tailspin, you know, the everything goes with it, because you got hedge funds that are selling everything not nailed down to try and avoid margin calls.
Right.
And
right.
So they're going to sell everything, and you know, their gold and silver futures contracts are just as liquid as anything else, so that, you know, they dump it all. But then you get to a point where all of a sudden flight to safety money starts coming into the metals, and then the mining stocks follow. And we saw that there was a May 2010. There was a day when the Dow was down 1,000 points intraday.
Mm-hmm.
And when it started going down from, say, from zero to down 500, gold and silver and the Huey Index were getting hammered also. But when the Dow started moving from, say, down 500 to down 1,000, gold and silver and the Huey Index had a U turnaround and moved a lot higher. They both actually closed green on the day. I think the Dow closed down, I want to say, I don't know, 600 points that day, something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, we can only go by what we've observed in the past. You know, and it could be different this time. And that's why, again, I think you need to have some money completely outside the system in the form of physical gold and silver. But, you know, if you believe that we're going to have systemic continuity whenever what happens, I think you can make a lot of money on the mining stocks.
Yep. That's what a lot of people are in your camp, that's for sure. Well, all right, my friend, we have reached the end of our time, and we've gone longer than what I expected. So first of all, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time. It's always fun to get your opinions on this stuff, Dave, because you watch this stuff like a hawk, and it's a learned, wise set of opinions you're able to share. So thank you for that. But before I let you go, though, you know, we've got this tradition around here we call the Final Four.
Yeah, I knew that was coming.
So if you're ready, can I hit you with them?
Yeah, by the way, no problem going over what you thought we would. I mean, we always do, so I just assume we will.
All right, well, remember, at the end here, we can answer them pretty quickly with just a word, a sentence. Whatever just first comes to your mind is always the most fun, right? So I'll start you with this one. You know what time of year it is, so you probably had to figure this one was coming. How many wins will the Denver Donkeys notch this year?
First of all, I'd like to make a correction. It's the Denver Broncos.
To everyone outside of Colorado, it's the Denver Donkeys. But within Colorado, you're right, it's the Denver Broncos.
People call them the Donkeys here when they're losing. I think the over-under for the Broncos this year will be 10 games.
10? Wow. Okay. I'm writing that one down. We'll check back on that one the next time we talk. All right. There was this mini controversy a week ago when John McEnroe said that Serena, if she would, you know, we had to rank her amongst the men, she'd maybe be around number 700 in the world. But I think that's probably right. But I want to know what you think. Where would you rank Serena Williams currently, at present, in the ranking of all tennis players in the whole world, including men?
Boy, that's a tough one to answer. I take lessons from a guy who at one point was ranked in the top 200 in the ATP.
Yeah.
And he's actually good friends with Patrick McEnroe. And I got to tell you, I think, and I never saw him play in his prime. I can see what he can do now. I think Serena would be ranked higher than 700 if she was on the men's tour. I want to say she'd probably be in the top 300, but I don't necessarily, I'm with you, Turd, I don't necessarily disagree with McEnroe's comment because, there's a big difference between just the physical nature of men and women tennis players and believe it or not, I mean, even outside of the top four or five players in the world, there's not a lot of difference between, say, number 10 and number 200.
Sure.
In fact, the guy that I hit with almost beat Brad Gilbert when Brad Gilbert was ranked fourth. And this, when he almost beat Gilbert, I think my friend was ranked just inside of 200. He had him on two match points and couldn't convert it. So that, it's not a big difference between, say, the fifth ranked guy and the 200th ranked guy out there.
I just thought it was a silly made up controversy because, I mean, in no other sport do we say, well, yeah, boy, the woman's track and field runner or the women's golfer or the women's basketball. I mean, you're not going to take the best WNBA player and put her on an NBA team and expect her to hang 25, right?
I would think that, most Division I men's college basketball teams would beat the best WNBA team.
Yeah. I mean, it's a separate thing by gender, but other people all pissed off, and make it sound like it's a race issue even because, what?
I mean, it's crazy. He's good friends with Serena.
I mean, it's just ridiculous.
It's McEnroe, man. I mean, that's the guy who told the umpire at Wimbledon that those guys were the worst.
That's right. I mean, I just thought it was silly. All right, next question. What is the percentage likelihood of a war on the Korean Peninsula in the next 12 months?
It's impossible to know. It's impossible.
You're supposed to just guess.
To what degree they're postulating, I'd say 30%.
Wow, that's a big number. Holy smokes. Okay.
I'm just throwing it out there. I mean, Trump's unpredictable, but again, he's not the one who's calling the shots. I think the guys behind him in the deep state, I think they're even more insane than he is.
All right. And again, recognizing you're Colorado and, your number one answer might be granola or weed. what is your favorite pizza topping after granola and weed?
Oh, it's got to be mushrooms, right?
No, mushrooms, exactly. There you go.
Actually, it's pretty simple. I like pepperoni.
Fair enough. That is a very nice, easy one. Okay, pepperoni. I'll write that down. All right, my friend. Hey, thank you so much. Again, I want to remind everybody, go to investmentresearchdynamics.com. You can sign up for the Mining Stock Journal. You can sign up for the Short Sellers Journal. If you're in there trying to make money in either one, you need some help, and Dave's the best in the business, so I encourage everybody to check it out. Dave, thank you so much for your time. It's always a pleasure to visit with you, and hopefully we will do this again soon.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Great to be in Turdville again, and thanks for the kudos, whether it's warranted or not. Who knows?
It is warranted, and thanks to everybody for listening. We'll do this again next week.